The envelope looks innocent enough, usually, but then sticker shock.
What? I'm paying all this for what?
Medical bills are expensive and really hard to understand.
Because you called a CAT scan a $6,000 expense, it doesn't make it so.
In a moment, the quest to untangle medical bills and find the real cost of care. This is The Pulse, bringing you stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation.
I'm Tanya English.
I'm Alana Gordon.
I'm Zach Seward.
I'm Elizabeth Perez Luna.
I'm Jeanette Woods.
And I'm Maiken Scott. Today, The Pulse makes its debut. Every week, we'll take you inside the heads of scientists and researchers into the hallways and treatment rooms of busy hospitals. You'll learn about rising trends in medical care and how they affect you.
Innovation drives the creative economy.
It is the cutting edge of what modern neuroscience can do.
Brain injury survivors still are capable of doing many things.
I think there's a notion that researchers are in some sort of ivory tower.
This is my health.
We're not just a body, we're not just a head.
Robots are really just computers with motors.
The speed at which they can process information, their ability to filter
out. In addition to your knee pain, you're also dealing with insomnia.
On today's show, doctors usually ask us how we feel, but New York physician Danielle Ofri says that what doctors feel can be the elephant in the treatment room. Science writer Faye Flam goes on a journey to improve her sense of direction, but gets lost along the way, and will meet a cardiologist who sets up shop in a hair salon. But first, let's get back to those crazy medical bills. Have you ever tried to find out how much a specific procedure costs before having it? Or did you ever get a bill where a seemingly simple pill costs several hundred dollars? Healthcare consumers often feel helpless and mystified as huge bills get batted back and forth between insurance companies and care providers. But quite possibly, the murky waters of medical billing are about to part. Zach Seward is here. Hi, Zach.
Hi, Maiken.
And Zach, this is a really complicated issue. It affects all of us in the form of high insurance premiums, high co-pays, huge medical bills. And your story starts with one patient's tale.
That's right. One patient, one story. But this feeling of kind of being stranded should sound familiar to a lot of people. So Jessica Tranchina had a baby boy.
I had a natural birth, completely natural, no epidural or any meds of any sort.
Tranchina and her husband had insurance. They met their deductible, but they were still faced with this staggering hospital bill, like months after the fact. Their insurance wouldn't cover everything, and the bills that they received were kind of crazy.
There was where did the olive oil come from? Oh my goodness, a teaspoon? Or what is that, a tablespoon? Or 120 mils of olive oil is $15. Why didn't I bring my own?
It adds up quick, that plus the big ticket items, and Tranchina is on the hook for $11,000. She says the hospital hounded her for months.
Threat after threat from the hospital, this is going to affect your credit, we're going to send this off to collectors.
So the bills get batted back and forth, they wind up in collections, until Tranchina gets put in touch with a small company an hour outside Philadelphia that helps her go through the charges line by line and negotiate a deal.
We're not trying to put our fingers in anybody's chest. We're trying to make sure that the patient feels supported and defended. We're going to protect their rights.
That's ELAP Services. It's this company that's on the front lines of the war against escalating medical costs. Now, that was CEO and President Steve Kelly, and he says part of his company's mission is to demystify medical bills. They're working to figure out a fair price, basically, for a given medical service.
So could I call them up if I have a problem with a medical bill?
Well, not really. They work with businesses who choose to self-insure, and if you work for one of those companies and you had a problem, they would work with you to fix it.
What's a self-insured business?
So I'll explain that in a minute.
Okay.
Okay, so Steve Kelly, the CEO of that company we just heard from, he says that medical billing works like this. A hospital will essentially overcharge for its services. They fully expect the patient's insurance company to demand a discount. So if the price is going to be knocked down, the hospitals would say you had better start high.
Nobody would do business in any other area. In other words, if I said to you this chair is for sale, it's $50,000, but I'm going to give you a 20% discount. You would laugh.
Another employee at ELAP, Krista Haig, she audits medical bills for a living, and she has seen some doozies.
We have seen one line for $500 for a acetaminophen tablet, which you can get from Amazon.com, an entire bottle of 500 of those tabs for like, you know, $1.50.
ELAP says implants, say a hip or a knee, are also a big area for inflated charges. Hospitals will implant one but charge for two. Here's Steve Kelly with yet another example.
Because you called a CAT scan a $6,000 expense, it doesn't make it so.
So, Zach, why does this company, ELAP, why do they untangle these medical bills?
Well, they do this because they work with companies that choose to self-fund their insurance plans. So that means Auto Dealership X sets aside money for their employees' health claims instead of paying a per-worker premium to an insurance company. Now, for the worker, it works pretty much just like regular insurance. But for the company, it's an opportunity to control their health costs. Kelly says this is really a growing niche.
And we work with them to develop rational reimbursement policies to try to shield them from the irrational process of medical billing.
What ELAP does is say, hey, hospital, our client will pay you this much for this service. And the goal here is to hammer out a degree of transparency that's otherwise unavailable to them.
And there's often quite a bit of friction.
But, Kelly says, it works about 80% of the time.
But, Zach, how come people can haggle with hospitals and doctors like that over bills? I mean, ELAP is doing the same thing that insurance companies apparently do, which is say, I'm not going to pay that. Give me a better price.
Yeah, hospitals and doctors have different price tags for procedures depending on the payer. So they'll charge insurance company A one thing for a CAT scan, and government payer B will pay another price for that same CAT scan. You know, individuals get another price, and insurance company C probably worked out its own deal. It's really complicated, so I wanted to talk to the hospitals about it.
What one hospital charges for a specific service is not necessarily what another hospital charges for that service.
That's Martin Chickichop, and he's the vice president for research at the Hospital and Health System Association of Pennsylvania. He says from a hospital perspective, it's not really about what one particular thing costs, so forget the $10 aspirin pill. He says it's all about making sure that those things add up so that the hospital can stay in business. Having a clear menu with fixed pricing is pretty much a thing of the past. Chickichop says it may stay that way.
Getting every payer to agree to pay a sustainable common rate for each service, you know, would be ideal, but in our marketplace, it doesn't seem like there's a way that we can get there.
But companies like ELAP, that negotiation slash untangling company we met earlier, really disagree with that vision. They say that transparency in billing means lower healthcare costs for employers.
And if you get insurance through your employer, as an employee, you pay a portion for that, so obviously you would benefit from lower costs. But what about individuals who are buying insurance on their own? Why is knowing the price of procedures and care important to them?
Experts would say that the price tag for procedures actually matters more now. I mean, copays are rising, more people have plans with high deductibles, and that's kind of the landscape that Jeannie Pinder found herself in, right? She was a former reporter for the New York Times, and now she runs this website called clearhealthcosts.com.
We're a New York City-based startup bringing transparency to the healthcare marketplace by telling people what stuff costs.
All right, so I am on the website now, clearhealthcosts.com. It's in New York City and six other markets at this point. But let's say I need a lower back MRI. It shows me that the lowest price for that MRI is $400 over in Kew Gardens, and the highest price is $1,200 for the same thing over in Midtown Manhattan.
So that's an $800 price difference.
Yeah, and some of the other stuff here is equally, you know, divergent.
And can you see other options or only lowest and highest?
I can see other prices as well. It shows me 14 other options should I really want to delve in and see what I would pay.
So I could really shop around and pick, I guess, as long as the place checks out. Otherwise, I could pick an option that fits my wallet.
Yeah, yeah. And Pinder says wading through this stuff matters. They get their numbers from the Medicare reimbursement rate, which is available via the government. They do pricing surveys in the markets they're in. And they also do crowdsourcing with people reporting what they paid. Now, Pinder says the medical landscape is shifting. And with it, you and me are probably paying more out of pocket for health coverage. Pinder says the question of what costs how much where has to re-enter the conversation.
We think this marketplace is broken not just in cost transparency, but also in quality transparency.
Pinder says it's not that people should get the cheapest possible procedure. It's that it should just be easier to find out what, if anything, makes the $3,000 option better than the $300 one.
And that's what we all want. We don't want the cheapest appendectomy. We want the best for the money. We want the best value.
And it pays to remember the big picture here. Over half of all personal bankruptcies in the U.S. today are caused at least in part by medical debt.
I've heard from a lot of people who have tried to find out the price of a procedure beforehand, and they didn't get anywhere. The doctor didn't know. The hospital office didn't know. And they were having a hard time finding out themselves. But I'm thinking when more people ask questions, the answers might be more forthcoming.
You would think, and consumer advocates really stressed, be an informed consumer. Ask these questions, and while you're at it, get these answers in writing. Things are known to shift in the healthcare marketplace when it comes to insurance and payment. So, again, it's about asking questions and being informed as to what your healthcare actually costs.
Thank you, Zach.
You're welcome, Mikan.
Ever open up the mail to find one of these eye-popping bills? Let us know on Twitter at WHYY The Pulse. So who sends out these missives of financial doom, also known as medical bills?
Now I'm forgetting the letters. Wait a minute. Yeah. All right, I'm putting in the account number.
Rita Genovese at Jefferson Hospital oversees all the medical billing and coding for the Department of Medical Oncology and the infusion centers.
So there's misconceptions on what a coder is. There's a lot of education behind being a coder.
Coders have to know anatomy and take a huge national test on thousands of codes. They have to review the medical charts to bill for the right treatments and the amount of time of treatment and so on. It's complicated.
So you just don't wake up one day and say, I'm a coder.
In fact, they live, breathe, and dream codes.
71516 is, you know, knee arthritis. We have depression, which is, you know, 311. So there's many codes that are on a daily basis that you see. If you work in a particular specialty, you kind of always see those codes. It can get a little crazy. A lot of times when you're a coder, you'll watch a TV show, and let's say if it's a murder mystery or if it's a medical show especially, and something occurs, you kind of code it in your head, which is really funny. And people ask me questions about that because I'm also bilingual. So people ask me if I think in Italian or think in English, and I actually think in both, depending on the situation. It's the same thing with coding. Like, you know, you might be around with coders and you're seeing something together and you're like, that's a 311, that's a 280.00, you know, and that's how you think. You have to have the passion to be a coder. And you have to really be able to know where to find things. That's the main thing. But you have to love what you do.
That's medical biller and coder Rita Genovese of Jefferson University Hospital. Think about those thousands and thousands of files all containing coded information. To the average person, that sounds intimidating, but not to evolutionary geneticist Rob Colathanol. To him, it sounds more like something he'd like to sink his teeth into.
We can take huge data sets, we could throw them into a computer, and we could run our analyses quite easily. And that's something we're good at. We look for patterns.
Could Colathanol make sense of medical billing? It's hard to say, but he is using the tools of his geneticist trade to better understand how technology evolves. We'll meet him in a minute. Stay tuned to The Pulse here on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca is focused on the discovery and development of prescription medicines to treat some of the world's most serious diseases. With its U.S. headquarters in Wilmington, Delaware, AstraZeneca operates in more than 100 countries, and its medicines are used by millions of patients worldwide. More at AstraZeneca-US.com or at the company's blog at azhealthconnections.com. AstraZeneca proudly supports WHYY's The Pulse.
The latest healthcare developments.
How what happens in Washington affects you.
How world events affect us all.
The news continues throughout your day. I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. We are your co-hosts for Here and Now. Breaking news, thoughtful analysis, surprising interviews in the middle of your day.
With voices from all across the country so you won't miss a thing.
That's Here and Now from NPR and WBUR Boston.
This afternoon at 1 on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross is proud to support WHYY's The Pulse. Independence Blue Cross is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents will be available to help clear up confusion, answer questions, and even help you decide on a policy. IBC is dedicated to helping you make the best decision with your health insurance. The Independence Express truck is visiting neighborhoods now. More information online at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
I'm Mike and Scott. Welcome back to The Pulse, stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. When you're living in a brain-heavy region like ours, you may find yourself standing in line at the coffee shop with a guy who is trying to 3D print organs. Or maybe you're sipping cocktails with a doctor who's growing lettuce leaves to make vaccines. This can all lead to some pretty amazing conversations, and we create those kinds of conversations in our segment. So, what do you do? We team up a layperson with one of the region's many scientists for a down-to-earth talk about heavy-duty research. This week, Matt Skoufalos, a freelance writer and musician from New Jersey, asks Rob Colathanol, an evolutionary biologist and geneticist from Temple University.
What can we say you do?
Well, first of all, I'm an evolutionary biologist. I'm interested in change, change at the molecular level, change at the genetic level, change at the organismal level, how species change over time. But as a geneticist, I'm interested in change at the gene level. And I'm interested in the forces that actually cause those changes. Mutational forces, how gene flow, how selection, and how drift can actually change allele frequencies or genes across space and time.
Can you tell me about what an allele frequency is?
If you remember, in basic genetics, we have two sets of genes. So for a given gene, we have a copy that's from your mother and a copy that's from your father. These are what we call alleles. So alleles are basically different representations of that gene. These are different forms of a single gene.
So this is more like the argument of who you can blame which parent for which of your problems that you have?
I think we should just blame them equally for every single problem that we have.
Right. I didn't ask to be born. I didn't ask to have these issues. All right. I'll only throw this one at you.
That's a sociological question.
Okay. Fair enough. As a kid, I read a lot of comic books, and there were people who had crazy superpowers like growing wings or shooting laser beams, something like that. Is it possible evolutionarily for us to get to that place?
For something like that, for wings to arise, you must have many years, you must have a lot of time, and you must have a constant selective pressure that basically allows a variation that's found in a population to be molded into an individual with wings.
So it wouldn't be until we became like an arboreal, cliff-dwelling kind of species that we would need to grow wings, so we were pushing our children literally out of the nest before that would happen?
Well, perhaps one day, if there was variation in a population, and if some individuals had small little wings in the back of their pack, maybe one day we could actually select for those over many, many, many generations.
All right, an easier one. What about prehensile tails or picking things up with our feet, thumbs on our hands? Come on, help me out here. When do we get to be cooler?
We are cool. And that's actually kind of the coolest thing about evolution. We are species that are at around 7 billion individuals right now. There is a lot of room for mutational processes to take place. You know, years ago when our species was at, 100,000, mutation had to accumulate over a long time. Now with 7 billion people, mutations take place that much faster.
Rob and Matt talked for about 30 more minutes about evolution and what might be next for the human race, and then they got onto some new stuff Rob is working on. He's using the tools of his geneticist trade to track the development of technology.
You know, using evolutionary theory with organisms really makes sense because these organisms undergo mutation. These organisms have gene flow between different populations or between individuals. There's selection that takes place in populations, and there's also drift that can take place, especially if you have a small population. Now, you could actually use these principles of evolution to understand how certain non-biological entities evolve. For example, we've been looking to see how WordPress, which is a very popular platform for blogging as well as for websites, we've looked to see how this platform has evolved since its inception in 2005 over time. So if we could take a social construct, if we could take a technology such as WordPress, we could reinvent an underlying genetic code for that platform and then look to see what forces are acting upon that platform over time. So in 2005, there was only a few WordPress websites. And now it's 2013, and there's a lot more. There's tens of thousands of websites. And each of them has their own genetic structure. Over time, we can actually see how these things have evolved, how certain interactions have changed.
What do you see as the future, technologically speaking, of stuff like this?
I don't know, because we're just in the early stages of working on it right now. Not many people do this. In fact, no one does this.
Well, one person does.
Well, so what can we make out of this? I don't know yet. This is an experiment, and we're going to see where this takes us.
Thanks very much. I feel like I learned a whole lot.
And thank you. I haven't thought about these questions in a long time, and and it's really great to be given this opportunity to talk to you.
Rob Kalathanal, an evolutionary geneticist at Temple University, speaking with Matt Skoufalos, a writer and musician living in New Jersey. They enjoyed their chat so much they'll talk more over coffee. And Rob went to see Matt's band play last month. It's a David Bowie cover band called Candy Volcano. Do you want to be part of our So What Do You Do segment? Tweet us at WHYY The Pulse. Who do you talk to about your health? When do you feel comfortable enough to share problems you've had or maybe confess secret vices you indulge in every once in a while? A Philadelphia cardiologist goes to an unusual place to get some candid answers. Tanya English has this story.
Cardiologist Chaleshi Nkande Price has one of those hyphenated names and a hyphenated title to match. She's a physician researcher. When she's not caring for patients at the University of Pennsylvania, Nkande Price is in her research laboratory.
I'm going to list six conditions, okay? And if any of them are relevant, you just say yes. So, has your doctor ever told you that you've had a heart attack?
No.
Stroke?
We specialize in natural hair, weaves, braids, cuts, color.
For a couple days each week, Nkande Price sets up her lab in Tracy Johnson's hair salon, Trey Chic Hair Studio in Lansdowne, Pennsylvania.
Stylist or psychologist / hairstylist, so we could talk about any and everything, relationships, children.
African-American women develop heart disease at twice the rate of white women. And once black women have heart trouble, they're more likely to die from it. That's disturbing, but frankly, old news and incomplete.
Black women being more obese, black women having high rates of diabetes, but there was nothing out there saying the why. It was actually when I was at the hair salon myself and I was sitting under the hood and I heard stories about health, stories about family, stories about solutions, and I thought the truth is here.
Nkande Price is convinced that if she can just speak with enough women, she'll figure out how to better sell them the healthier habits that she's hawking. Habits that can lower a woman's risk for heart disease. In the downtime between getting her hair washed and coiffed, 28-year-old client Shaveen Green agrees to share her story.
I think there's a stigma about telling people your business, you know. some people just aren't okay with that. Or, you know, I think culturally it's like, you know, it stays in the family. What happens, you know, in our house stays in our house.
So if there's diabetes in my house, it stays here. If there is the inability to eat healthily, it stays here. Could you imagine if we shared the knowledge? Because I'm hearing stories of black women that are making it work.
At the salon, Nkande Price pushes a little by asking the same question several times in different ways.
Let's talk about the gym. Why were you able to go to the gym on that day?
My best friend, we go to the same gym, so I find it easier sometimes when, you know, she's going. I feel a little bit more motivated to go as well because I have a gym buddy. We just went together.
in the clinical setting, we don't ask that. As doctors, we tend to just say, do you or don't you exercise? And then when someone tells us the answer, we give a prescription, you should exercise more.
And that's the kind of insight Nkande Price is hunting. Ways to do her job better and ways for the health system to work better.
If the thing that we learned from this study is we need to ask better questions, well, maybe those could happen in the waiting room. Maybe it could even happen online before you get to the doctor's office.
For The Pulse, I'm Tanya English.
Nkande Price has developed a fitness challenge for women. It's called Change My Steps. You can find a link to that challenge at whyy.org/thepulse. The federal health law has taken center stage in recent months, but it's been receiving more catcalls than ovations.
Just as I thought! Obamacare has exploded the chest cavities of millions of Americans!
Okay, John Stewart, let's not get carried away. Things are a mess, but not quite that bad. The Pulse's Ilana Gordon has been following this story since the October rollout of the federal insurance marketplaces known as exchanges. Now she reviews that rocky ride and lets us know where things stand.
For some people, October 1st and the launch of the new healthcare marketplace offered a ray of hope.
Open enrollment! Yay!
Valerie Myers with Independence Blue Cross was in Philadelphia's suburban station early that day, promoting the insurer's offerings in the new marketplace. Blue Cross joined Aetna as the two local insurers offering plans on the exchange. Not everyone shared Myers' enthusiasm. The words of Nancy Barrett, a morning commuter, were an omen of problems to come.
This is not explained very well. The average person will never get it.
And so you stopped by to find some information out for a friend?
For my daughter, actually. She gets no health care through her employer.
Insurance coverage through these new marketplaces is slated to kick in as early as New Year's Day. It's intended for people who don't get health insurance through work and could affect upwards of 1 million people in Pennsylvania, Delaware, and New Jersey combined. People like 62-year-old Suzanne Cloud. Cloud's a jazz singer whose nonprofit tries to connect fellow musicians with benefits like healthcare. But she too needs coverage and was hoping the exchanges could help.
I'm really anxious to see what kind of benefit packages there are out there for what I need, for my particular typical chronic conditions that a person my age would have.
Cloud has diabetes, high blood pressure. She isn't old enough for Medicare. So she checked out healthcare.gov.
It's letting me log in now.
Cloud was able to create an account through the online portal, but
I got through that, and then it kind of went zzz, and something went wrong, and it just went to a page with all kinds of HTML stuff.
So let me go here, go to healthcare.org.
24-year-old Nathaniel Scott of South Philly also logged on to the portal, hoping it would lead to health coverage.
So I click the link. It takes me back to the login page of the healthcare.gov site, and it says, you know, invalid password. It doesn't take me further.
Scott, who works in IT, is exactly the kind of guy insurers want to enroll, young and healthy. And unlike many so-called young invincibles, he wants coverage.
My biggest concern is that one day, you know, I go through a medical emergency and I require, you know, a visit to a hospital or what have you. And then after I get out, I get, you know, a bill from the hospital for like thousands and thousands of dollars. And then my head's spinning saying, oh my goodness, how am I going to pay all this?
Scott and Cloud, as it turned out, were among thousands of Americans for whom healthcare.gov was an early bust.
In these early weeks, access to healthcare.gov has been a miserably frustrating experience for way too many Americans.
Health and Human Services Secretary Kathleen Sebelius acknowledged the website woes.
I apologize. I'm accountable to you for fixing these problems.
During the first month, she reported about 50,000 people in Delaware, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania were able to use the site to create applications. But that's only half the battle. 59-year-old Janice Baker, a resident of Delaware, was one of the reported 100 or so in the state who actually made it the whole way through, signing up with an insurer. She says it was a two-week effort.
If I wasn't so hard-headed, I don't think I would have gotten it done.
The launch hasn't been a universal disaster. Some states running their own marketplaces have had more success. In New York, more than 70,000 people have been able to enroll. But the rollout's taken another nasty turn for people like 33-year-old Danielle Gatto.
I received the letter about a month ago.
The notice from her insurer stated,
my health coverage will be discontinued as of January 1st, 2014.
That's because her plan, like many others, doesn't meet new benefit standards under the federal health law. Gatto doesn't love her coverage. It doesn't cover her treatment for Crohn's disease. But she's stressed out, trying to find an affordable option that covers what she needs.
It just sort of made my head spin to try to figure out these numbers and make them fit my actual life, you know?
Thanks to some last-minute steps by the Obama administration and her insurer, Gatto now has another 6 months with her current plan as she tries to find better options. As for Scott and Cloud, they're hopeful, but at least for now, 2 months in, both are still trying to enroll. For The Pulse, I'm Alana Gordon.
I can't hear a waltz. Oh, my Lord, there it goes again. Why is nobody dancing in the street?
Is your head spinning like Danielle Gatto's from these new healthcare marketplaces? We've got some tips for breaking through confusion on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Also, this month, the feds have said they've improved the healthcare.gov website. Have you given it a shot and tried to sign up for insurance? If so, let us know how that went at thepulse@whyy.org. Coming up on The Pulse, we'll meet a doctor who lets us in on a bit of a secret. Have you ever wondered what your physicians might be thinking as they so confidently examine your ailments?
I'm really not good enough to be a doctor. I better quit now.
A conversation about doctors and their complicated feelings, self-doubt, fear, shame. Stay tuned to The Pulse here on WHYY.
Independence Blue Cross supports WHYY's The Pulse and is coming to your neighborhood to help you with the new healthcare law. Licensed agents can help explain the changes and prepare you for what's ahead. More at ibx.com/events. Independence Blue Cross. Live fearless.
The HBO documentary Six by Sondheim, featuring interviews with and music by Stephen Sondheim, debuts Monday. On the next Fresh Air, David Bianculli reviews it, and we feature our 2010 interview with Sondheim. Join us.
This afternoon at 3, and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
The man of the century, the last century.
A man who took history in his hands and bent the arc of the moral universe towards justice.
From prisoner to president, Nelson Mandela and the way forward for Africa and the world. Voices of the people who knew him best on The Takeaway, next time from PRI Public Radio International.
Today at noon on WHYY.
Supporting WHYY's The Pulse, AstraZeneca is a global biopharmaceutical business focused on the discovery and development of prescription medicines to treat the world's most serious diseases. Learn more at AstraZeneca-US.com.
I'm Mike and Scott. Welcome back to The Pulse, bringing you stories at the heart of health, science, and innovation. We'd love to know what you think of the show. Share your thoughts with us on Twitter at WHYY The Pulse. Bellevue Hospital in New York is the nation's oldest public hospital. It's a bustling, busy, and well-known place. Physician Danielle Ofri has been at that hospital for over 15 years. She has curly, dark hair. She wears sensible shoes and a warm fleece shirt. Her handshake is firm. She walks and talks with confidence. The kind of doctor you'd trust to be calm, collected, and competent. But she says she doesn't always feel so confident.
Fear is woven into the daily existence of medicine.
fear that we will harm our patients, kill them, forget something, miss a diagnosis.
Ofri visited us in Philadelphia to talk about her new book, What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine.
The first time I ran a code, a cardiac arrest, and I got there and the patient is, you know, has no blood pressure and there's a code team, and I couldn't think of a single thing to do. My mind blanked out to nothingness. And I couldn't say a thing for fear that I would be wrong. And I remember looking at the EKG thinking, could this be elevated potassium? But I'm afraid to say it if it's wrong. And it turned out that I was right. You know, someone else came in, made the diagnosis, and the patient, you know, did as well as they can do in a code. But my fear had prevented me from speaking, even though I'd made the correct diagnosis. And I think that fear is part of our life all the time. And I think that what we need to do as mature professionals is we need to find, kind of negotiate a ground with our fear. We need to keep some of it for a healthy fear of what we're doing. But the part that becomes overwhelming, we need to recognize that. And there are moments when it is overwhelming, and then we need to step back, step out of the room, get help, find another time to deal with it, because otherwise it will come out. And I think that doctors who are so afraid of looking ignorant or making a mistake might just say whatever comes to their mind until they sound like they know what they're talking about. And that's actually more dangerous than saying, you know, I really don't know, or I'm, you know, at this moment I can't do it. Someone else give me a hand.
Go back to that moment when you were too afraid to speak. The patient was fine. Somebody else stepped in. But what happened to you afterwards? How did you know what happened? Did you think about it?
I felt like an idiot. I said, boy, I'm really not good enough to be a doctor. I better quit now. And I think back now, years later, had someone come up to me and said, you know, taken me aside, said, you know, boy, you must have really had a tough moment there. And I could have spoken about it on the spot or shortly thereafter. It might have resolved those feelings. Maybe someone would have said, you know, everyone goes through that, as opposed to thinking, boy, I am the loser. I'm a fraud in this class. I better be kicked out. And those feelings, they stay with us. And you know, it would have been so beneficial if someone had recognized that in this young fledgling doctor who I was and tended to those feelings at the moment. I might have been spared, you know, all those doubts that trailed me for so long.
Physicians tend to put on their game face, says Danielle Ofri, despite feelings of self-doubt and shame over possible mistakes, and she thinks the culture of perfectionism is so pervasive it prevents healthcare providers from discussing a very important opportunity for learning, near misses, when something almost goes very wrong. During our conversation, she recalled this incident from early on in her career.
I was on call as a second-year resident. It was a crazy night. I trained at Bellevue, a big city hospital. And the mode of survival when you were on call was to turf as many patients off your service as possible, because the more you could discharge or transfer to other services, the more you could tend to the other patients. You were in an untenable situation. So we got the classic eye-roller admission, the nursing home patient, 90 years old with an altered mental status. You know, they start out with looking demented. They're a bit more demented today, and you know, we have patients who were bleeding and patients really sick, and for this, we just rolled our eyes. So we thought, let's get this patient to the intermediate care unit as quickly as possible. And I remember calling the intermediate care unit and saying, we got this old lady, she's fine, has to go back to her nursing home, and I kind of shunted her off. Turns out the patient was bleeding in their head, and I didn't check the CAT scan. Someone said CAT scan's fine, I didn't really check. When I found out the next day, I was horrified, so ashamed of what I had done. Now, it was a near miss because someone else saw the bleed. The system worked. And the patient was transferred to neurosurgery. And so I didn't tell anyone because I felt horrible. I didn't tell my team. I didn't tell my supervisor. And I sure as heck didn't go to the patient and the family and say, you know, I made an error. And it took me 25 years to write about it. Because it felt so horrible. And I look back now and see what a missed opportunity. Had I felt that it was okay to tell my supervisor, my attending could have said, you know, let's talk about that. Let's A, see how the error occurred, how can we prevent that. But let's talk about, you know, what it means for you. And let's go together to the patient's family. And I'll show you how to talk to a family about an error. So it's a very emotional thing. And I remember it to this day. Do I remember the textbooks I read? Not so much, but I remember those medical errors.
Of course, another big reason why doctors tend to be mum about near misses is the constant threat of lawsuits, something Ofri has experienced.
So I've been through a few. Thankfully, none have gone to trial, but I've had to make depositions and talk with lawyers, and it's a horrible feeling. You know, it feels like you're being raked over the coal, sitting down with a lawyer who's reading your medical notes and not particularly interested in the nuances of care, but what you wrote on that page on that day. And it's like standing naked in front of this, you know, panel of judges who's examining your every flaw and every bulge. And it's a different – they're looking for the hole in the armor. It's like they're trying to trip you up. And in medicine, we're trying to do the kind of the opposite, trying our best to, you know, help a patient's care. And it's very global, holistic, if you want to use that word, very nuanced. And it isn't always cut and dried, but the lawsuits feel very cut and dried. It's a particularly awful feeling. And most doctors who've been through a suit, it's devastating. It's like a death in the family. And it's the death of the doctor you thought you were. Most doctors and most doctors who get sued are good and committed doctors, are trying their best to do the right thing. And there are a few quacks out there, but they're really a minority. And so for most doctors feel, if I practice good medicine, you know, I won't be sued. And then it happens, and they've suddenly lost their innocence.
Danielle Ofri is a physician at Bellevue Hospital in New York. Her new book is What Doctors Feel, How Emotions Affect the Practice of Medicine. She did say the general culture in her profession is changing to allow for discussions about grief, about mistakes, but it's happening very slowly. And what does Ofri do to cope with the stress of her profession? She's learning to play cello. One emotion we didn't get to talk about with Danielle Ofri is frustration at patients who won't change their behaviors no matter what their doctor says. That is the topic of this week's Patient File, a regular segment that tells your stories of illness, recovery, health, and coping. In this week's Patient File, a heavy dose of I Told You So.
Hi, my name is Bradley Beck. I live in Wallingford, Pennsylvania. I'm a comedian and a podcaster. So I was at work. It was the Thursday before Easter, and I felt this pain in the side that could only be described as kind of like a gas-like pain. And it kept getting stronger and stronger. In the middle of the night, the pain got unbearable to the point where I couldn't fall asleep. It was just getting worse and worse and more intense. And my wife said, oh, we got to take you to the hospital. So it's like 4 in the morning, and we pack up my one-year-old daughter. We get in the car. It's a 10-minute drive to the hospital. I'm screaming in pain. I end up just uncontrollably vomiting all over the front of the car. And then my daughter, she just bawling and crying. She has no idea what's going on. It's awful. We finally get to the hospital, and after a few minutes, I'm checked in, and the nurse immediately says that I have kidney stones. A couple hours later, I wake up, they have me urinate in a paper cone, and there it is, staring right back at me, is this kidney stone. The doctor told me in a few days to follow up with my physician. So I did. And he said to me, do you drink soda? And I said, yeah, I drink soda. He said, well, you have to stop. It contributes to the forming of kidney stones, and it's just terrible for you. So I said, all right, I will stop drinking soda. I want to start, you know, caring about my health. So I stopped drinking soda for approximately 1 month. And then I went back, and I told my wife, I said, you know, I want to have a little bit of soda. I don't think it's a big deal if I drink it once in a while. And she said, well, that's fine, but I'm telling you, if you get a kidney stone again, you're driving yourself to the hospital. So fast forward to 4 years later. Peaceful until I woke up at 4 in the morning with this intense pain on my side, and my wife said, you know what, just drive yourself to the hospital now. It's only going to get worse. Sure enough, she didn't drive me. I had to drive myself to the hospital. They gave me the medicine. I fell asleep, and I may or may not have passed a stone. And when I got back that morning, my wife said to me, so was it worth it? And I said to her, well, if the punishment for me drinking soda is that every 4 years I'm going to be in like absolute pain for a couple hours. Yeah, it's totally worth it.
That's Bradley Beck talking about his kidney stones.
Can can I have a question for you?
Yes.
So what's WHYY's policy about drinking in the studios?
Drinking what?
Well, I just have something.
What is it?
It's a red can of soda with a curvy white line on the side of it. Would you care to try some?
Sure.
A roll of the dice?
Thank you. Cheers.
Cheers. You know what that tastes like to me?
What's that?
That's the taste of free will.
So, does soda really contribute to kidney stones? The research is not entirely clear, but studies have shown a link. It also depends on what kinds of kidney stones you're prone to. Other foods patients are supposed to limit are animal protein, nuts, spinach, and rhubarb. Well, that's not all that hard. But really, do patients ever do what they are supposed to?
I think that most of my patients follow most of my advice most of the time. How about that?
I don't believe you.
Many of my patients follow some of my advice occasionally.
That's Michael Baim. He's an internist, and he also directs the Penn Center for Mindfulness.
It's hard to do all of the things that really take care of your body. It's hard enough to remember to change the oil in your car every 3 months. So do you really want to skip that luscious dessert? Do you really want to get up an hour earlier to sweat in the gym while everybody else is still asleep?
So what do you call that? As a doctor, we used to call it doctor's orders. Maybe it's advice. Maybe how do you even phrase that when you're talking to a patient?
I have never been the kind of a doctor that gives commands. Not because I don't wish that I could sometimes, but just realistically, it doesn't work. I think that behavior change happens better, is more successful, and certainly lasts more when people make choices for themselves. I think of it more as really giving information. So if you do this, you're going to feel better, or this is going to work better. Letting people know that they'll get something that they want, not giving them something that they have to do.
Does that get frustrating, though, if you see a patient over time, and every time you see them, you say, look, maybe you should do this, this, and this, and they come back, and they have the same complaints, and they haven't changed any of their behaviors?
The thing that is frustrating as a doctor is not, to me, is not that people don't follow my advice, but then that they don't take responsibility. Like, I never heard that before, when I know darn well that they heard it a bunch of times. And so, you know, we don't want to accept responsibility for things that don't go well. And that's really where I kind of feel, come on.
Do you follow doctor's orders?
Yeah, of course I don't completely follow doctor's advice. But I will say that I do my best. I hope my doctor isn't listening.
Michael Baim, a physician and director of the Penn Center for Mindfulness. Do you have a story you want to share with us for the patient files? Email us at thepulse@whyy.org. Science writer Faye Flam likes a good challenge. She recently set out to change something about herself that has bothered her for quite some time, and she documented her experience.
Do you hate maps? Or dread the words, some assembly required? Figuring out a route or putting together IKEA furniture requires spatial thinking, the ability to imagine objects in space. At Temple's Spatial Intelligence and Learning Center, psychologist Kristen Gagne explained that nearly everybody relies on spatial thinking in some way almost every day.
Every time you have to imagine, rearranging furniture in your house, you're relying on spatial thinking. Every time that you pack your suitcase, pack your fridge or your car, all of those things rely on spatial thinking.
I figured the best way to understand and explain spatial intelligence was to take some of the tests designed to measure it.
So this is a test of mental rotation ability.
Okay. So I've got an example here.
Yeah.
The first test they gave me was on mental rotation. You take a series of complicated line drawings representing 3D shapes and try to figure out how they would look if they were rotated.
And now, typically, I will time you.
Oh,
so
no.
So do you want to be timed?
I realized I was running the risk of learning I might be spatially deficient.
All right, you ready to roll?
I guess so.
Okay, go.
It's not that I'm afraid of tests, but You know how there was always that kid in every elementary school class who pledged allegiance with the left hand? That was me.
Looks like it's rotated to the right, and this would be... Gosh, these are impossible.
Five-sided chain. I wasted too much time on one of the problems. I got stuck.
Okay. So it's a very, very hard task.
And then the objects refused to rotate in my head.
So this one, if it's rotated 180 degrees...
Stop!
That's it?
Yeah, that's it.
Oh, well, I didn't get any.
I brought the answers.
I felt like I should have done better. It didn't seem possible I could be that inept. And the folks at the Temple Lab had lots of strategies for improving your abilities.
So a lot of the work that's been done is people will improve their spatial skills over, say, 12 weeks.
For me, unfortunately, they suggested 12 weeks of playing the video game Tetris. I've never played Tetris, but it sounds like the kind of thing I would hate.
I'm Dr. Nora Newcomb at Temple University.
Psychologist Nora Newcomb heads Temple's Spatial Intelligence and Learning Center.
One of the things that we've learned about spatial thinking is that it's very plastic, it's very trainable, it's very educable, and all of us can get better at this kind of thinking.
Being good at spatial tasks is not about having a dominant right or left brain.
Although the right hemisphere sometimes has certain specializations and the left hemisphere has some other specializations, the two hemispheres work together.
And that's good news, because that means spatial intelligence is just another skill we can work on improving. So maybe there is hope after all. For The Pulse, I'm Faye Flam.
Do you want to test your spatial intelligence? We have links to some of those tests on our website, whyy.org/thepulse. Earlier on The Pulse, we met some people who are teasing apart medical billing, trying to figure out why procedures cost what they cost and who gets charged what. We heard from our WHYY colleague Don Henry, who was trying really hard to find out how much his sleep study would cost.
You see, I need to know this information so that I can decide whether to have the procedure or not.
How did that turn out?
So I ended up getting two sleep studies, and I still have no idea what they cost.
For more on this story on medical billing and all the other stories on today's show, visit our website, whyy.org/thepulse. And please let us know what you think of The Pulse so far and what you'd like to hear on the show. And here's something we're working on for our next show. This week I met a scientist who just started working at the University of Pennsylvania. I call him the Lettuce Man because he is indeed growing lettuce, but this lettuce could maybe change the world.
To your right, you see the gene gun. this is used to fire human genes, in this case, insulin gene, and we shoot them into the plant cells.
That's our show for this week. The Pulse is a production of WHYY in Philadelphia. Our health and science reporters are Tanya English, Zach Seward, and Alana Gordon. Segments for today's show were produced by Jeanette Woods. Charlie Kyer is our engineer, Megan Pinto, our executive producer, Joel Patterson, our assistant producer. And we'd really like to hear from you. Email us with your feedback at thepulse@whyy.org. I'm Mike and Scott. Thank you for listening.